Monday, April 19th edition of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee, and today we are continuing our hearing with House Bill 5019, the Department of Environmental Quality agency presentations. And we left off in the Water Quality Division, and Michael Ellen was Division Administrator, was making a presentation with the Assistant Director Gates, set up to call them, and the Director, Mr. Lang Marsh, to the podium. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair, for the record, I'm Lang Marsh, Director of the DEQ, and we're prepared to continue with the water quality presentation this morning with Mike Lowe and Rick Gates. But we wanted to give you the opportunity, if you'd like, for us to start with the response to the public testimony that you heard on Thursday regarding some of the Willamette study issues. If you'd like, or we can do that later on in the presentation.
Let's begin there.
Okay. Ready?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Gates. In the studies on the Willamette River that the legislature asked the department to undertake since 1992 have given us a tremendous amount of additional knowledge about the river system. In keeping with the specified deliverables of the 14 separate contracts that we left, the department has received 52 technical reports covering various areas such as evaluation and calibration of the non-point source pollution model, the dissolved oxygen model, ecological monitoring, water quality survey data, point source discharges and waste loadings, land use characterization, toxic screening, plus several others, including the one biological assessment report that you heard about on Thursday. These results provide a realistic assessment of current information on the Willamette Basin and will also greatly support the implementation of PNDLs in the basin once we begin that effort. In that initial biological assessment report that was discussed on Thursday, the GATE method was selected by the Willamette River Technical Advisory Steering Committee because it looked promising as a quick screening method for surveying state health. Dr. Gady had developed a procedure to screen hatchery salmonid cells, and it had worked in his studies. In applying it to the Willamette River, it was determined that salmonids did not meet the criteria and could not be used. The criteria were, one, that the fish had to be a resident population in the river, and two, that the fish needed to be evenly distributed along the length of the river study area. The only fish that met these criteria were the squawfish and the suckers. The anadromous fish did not meet it because they are not resident, and the trout that were observed did not meet it because they were not evenly distributed along the entire length of the river system in the study area. In subjecting the squawfish and suckers to the GATE method, it just didn't work because the livers of these species do not have the same characteristics as the livers of the salmonid. The report acknowledged this, and it was basically an effort to try a study that looked promising, but it just didn't work out. In consideration of the thymus gland abnormalities, additional studies at Oregon State University are leading us to believe that there is a link between these abnormalities and the high incidence of parasite problems in Willamette fish. These studies have also sparked an interest by US EPA to support research on immune system problems with Willamette fish. In responding to the question concerning how does DEQ adopt appropriate scientific protocols and methods, the department fully utilizes established environmental analytical methods and protocols that are accepted in the environmental sciences. These are, for the most part, required or recommended EPA chemical methods and assessment protocols. In cases where something new or different needs to be incorporated, it is first peer-reviewed internally, it is then peer-reviewed with appropriate state agencies, it is also peer-reviewed by either an ad hoc committee of experts or specific university or industry experts. In the case of the Willamette studies, we were also directed by the legislature to form a technical advisory committee to help us oversee these projects. We are a scientific-oriented agency, and we strongly support the scientific method and quality assurance protocols in all our endeavors.
Sir? Representative Messler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that mean that you go to public hearing when you're developing the protocol?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messler, not a formal public hearing, but we do have a very public advisory process that we work. Frequently, we are very open to any public input on all of our methods. We try and invoke stakeholders to get involved when we're looking at new procedures.
If I could have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Do you advertise these as public meetings in which the public has an opportunity to voice their opinion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messler, we would be advertising on larger projects such as PMDL development and area-wide projects. On smaller scientific studies, I think it's pretty much done by word of mouth and inquiry.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Michael Well, and I'm the administrator of the Water Quality Division. What I'd like to do is pick up where I left off last Thursday with the overview of the water quality program.
So let me interrupt you for just a minute. I just wanted to pick any off the questions that Senator Lee brought to the committee before I was ready to do that. Senator Lee originally brought an issue forward about a series of research that was done over three biennia, I think. And her concern was that that data was either lost or unavailable. And I wonder if you could comment on that issue.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the data is very available. It's in hard copy. A lot of the information that was collected over the last 9 years is not in electronic data form at this point. We distributed the information to the library. We did check, by the way, on Senator Yee's question about the those reports being in the various libraries, which they are. But admittedly, the nature of the data being in hard copy is not as contemporary as we'd like it to be with the way some of the information that we would collect today would be, where we put it in the electronic form, making it accessible. As an example, over the internet, we have a website where people can go in and do basically bibliography search of information that we have that's more recent. We certainly can make that data eventually, at least in a bibliography sense, available so people know that these reports exist. They're rather voluminous, as you've seen. We also have a system that's called the SORET system, which is an EPA-based data, EPA-based data system in which when people collect water quality information that has received quality assurance, quality control, it's placed into the SORET system so that it's linked to a geographical area. As an example, if somebody wants to search for information at a particular river mile where there might be a monitoring station, that data is electronically available. But most of that data is the data that's collected by DEQ rather than third-party information. But we're moving in the direction of trying to, and actually one of the issues for the Willamette Basin being that there have been so many historical studies over the years, is that at some point putting an effort into compiling all that information in a logical sense so that people understand the trend, what data is more recent, as an example, I think would be worthwhile. But it's a massive effort with just literally thousands of pieces of data, individual pieces of data that exist.
Okay, I just wanted to confirm that the data is not lost or unavailable. It is available, simply not available in a conveniently accessible electronic format. What would the mechanism be for putting that information into a more usable electronic form? Is it a matter of just having somebody sit down and data enter that?
Mr. Chair, if the data exists in somebody's spreadsheet on a computer, we would quickly be able to get a copy, and then we can do an electronic transfer to the databases. It doesn't, and I'm afraid much of it may not. It's exactly what you say. We have to have somebody basically sit down and keep punching in.
Scanning will accomplish that, sir.
The scanning would scan for, excuse me, Mr. Chair, the scanning would scan the entire document in, but pulling each individual data piece out of it, we would need to put it in the correct format to get it into the database.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm understanding correctly, that there's some inherent methodological problems with the data, is it worth the effort to put it into electronic form?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, we believe it is worth the effort. The difficulty is just the mechanics of getting the data into the database. If the data itself is valuable, and we would hope that as we get these databases up to date, that we can come back and spend the time to put that data in.
President Jensen, follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where, if and where we have flawed data, and we make that data relatively available to the public, as we would with electronic information in this era, since often the public is unaware of the flaws, are we not running some risks of the wrong interpretation on the part of people who analyze it? Not professionals, but the public analysis of it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, we would not be looking to what we've flawed data. I guess misunderstanding, but we don't believe the data is flawed. The data that has been collected was subjected to appropriate quality assurance and quality control issues, and we believe the data is accurate as far as the QA goes on it. If there were data that was suspect and we put it into the database, it would go in with a flag on it, which would be indicating to what use this data could be used. It would not go in just as though the data were perfect data along with other norms here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Another question? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Walker.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to note for the record that I distributed an answer that the department made to some of the questions last week, and a copy of the slide that was requested by the committee from Dr. Hausman's report last week.
Thank you. Thanks for revisiting the issue of
I was out here last weekend, and I understand we're in tab 3, and I was saying on page 3 that it says we have 360 miles of ocean coastline. I think it may be how far it is from Washington to California, and kind of go around the curve of Cape Blanco, et cetera, but I suspect we have actually a lot more than 360 miles of coastline when we actually have the topography. I think my understanding is that Connecticut may have the longest coastline in the United States. Because of the change, I think that's actually a significant item. I just think 360 miles is low.
Yeah, let me get that with the team. We'll check on that. It might just be the mileage versus using a GIS tool to figure out all the little nooks and crannies, but we can check that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
I said they had a pretty good basketball team, too.
Oh, yeah.
What is it about today? It's Monday. We all had a great weekend. So we move forward back to the agency presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last Thursday, I was in... I'm on page 9. Put your hand up. Last week, I just began to discuss some of the threats to Oregon's water quality and had talked a little bit about nutrients and surface water, so I'll pick up with this slide. Some of the same sources of nutrients, as an example, can also impair groundwater. High nitrate levels in drinking water supplies are the main public health concern, and there's particular issues related to nitrates in infants, as an example. The map that you've got in front of you is a map where we conducted some nitrate sampling in groundwater, and the map shows where we've monitored for nitrates in particular. Red shows where nitrates have been detected. The black shows where nitrate levels are above the safe drinking water standard. The issue that we're trying to display with this map is that, first of all, our monitoring programs for groundwater are rather limited, but where we are looking at groundwater from an ambient monitoring standpoint, we are finding elevated nitrates in some parts of the state.
What's the principal source of the or sources of the elevated nitrate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I think it depends on where you are. Most of the nitrate contamination that we're familiar with comes from leaking or failing on-site systems, fertilizer, over-fertilizer application, as an example, where you have excessive fertilizers compared to the agronomic rate of the crops and the depth of groundwater. Those are the two primary sources.
Just to back up a couple of squares here for as a point of personal clarification, what, if there is nitrate in the groundwater or in the surface water, what are the mechanisms that they're dissipated or for getting them out of there? How do you deal with that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, in groundwater it's very difficult, which is one of the concerns with groundwater contamination, is because it's just not as easy to clean up as surface water. In many cases for nitrate contamination, there's not a lot you can do once it's been polluted. It's simply a matter of time and hopefully stopping the source and trying to correct it at that point.
So there's a function over time where the nitrates break down or something? Is that what we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, nitrates tend to break down more easily in surface water. And in groundwater, the mechanisms aren't just the exposure to bacteria or oxygen or other breakdown mechanisms isn't as available as it is in surface water. But I think over time, again, if you cut off the source, and depending on the aquifer that this contamination goes into, it may dissipate or basically be diluted to the point where it will drop below a health standard eventually.
And what's the mechanism with surface water for doing
that? Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the mechanism is basically the nitrogen cycle in surface water. You have phytoplankton and other aquatic plants that will start utilizing the nitrates as their own nutrient sources.
On the map we have here, you know, we're showing black and black for nitrate greater than 10 milligrams and nitrate is between 3 and 10. But on your screen we're looking at black is the strongest and orange is second, and you know that significant pool in north central Lane County is pretty salient there. It looks like there's a trail of the nitrates going along the close fork of the Atlantic River there, maybe the lower portion of the McKenzie. Wondering, you know, is it true in terms of what I'm seeing as going along those other rivers, but can you give me an indication of why that is so significant there in that Lane County spot when it's not the same going up the agricultural corridor of the Willamette Valley?
Representative Morgan, Mr. Chair, Representative King, I probably have to take a look at the specific data. I have a suspicion it is correlated to where the monitoring occurred. I believe that might be in the Colberg Junction City area. Is that? There's been a lot of monitoring in that area that was triggered by some local health department monitoring in private wells, and I think DEQ have gone in and taken a harder look at that particular area. So it may just be a function of where we've looked, but I'll certainly verify that for you.
So you're saying that there's a prospect that the entire Willamette Valley might look like that if we were monitoring the whole Willamette Valley?
Mr. Chair and Representative King, it's possible. If the same sources, the same hydrology, the same depth to groundwater, that's one of the things that we need to look at with the groundwater program.
And I guess in that case, I could stand to have a little education on the significance of nitrates between 3 and 10 milligrams.
Mr. Chair and Representative King, essentially the health standard for drinking water is 10 milligrams per liter. So where you see red as an example, it's not triggered above. Obviously, you're still below the standard. The problem that we see, however, is that most background concentrations of nitrates are significantly below 3 milligrams per liter, orders of magnitude below. So what you're seeing basically is a trend that we'd be concerned about. It's still safe to drink. But it's a trend that's indicating an excessive rate of nitrate loading to the aquifer. As I'll touch on later, we have one of the programs that DEQ has is to work with local governments where we're starting to see a trend like this to get better monitoring information, better collection of what might be the potential sources, and then identify some of the solutions. So it's more of a red flag, if you will, than a health concern at this point.
Cool. And if you're later going to be presenting information that shows a curve of that we're staying static or that we're actually increasing, you know, over periods of time, and that, you know, therefore there might be a concern that we hit the 10 milligrams, or that there are other impacts that we want to care about, I'd assume if you've seen that, but I suspect maybe you're going to be touching on that later.
I'll be talking later, Representative King, about the groundwater management area program.
Thank you.
What's your message?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see a lot of black and two shiny. I assume that's 10 mile lake.
I'll have to check, Representative Nessel.
Oh, right. Let me go on if I'm not sure.
Mr. Nessel, it sounds like you're ready to go off.
Yeah.
I wondered about all the coastal lakes also.
I have in your comments that it either comes through agriculture normally or through septic failure. I think one of the hottest places on that lake for nitrates is Black Creek, North Lake, which is half the lake. On one side of the lake, it's the railroad tracks, so there's no septic system. On the other side, most of the cabins, and they're pretty sparse to begin with, but are very limited cabins, where it has very little concentration. So it doesn't hold true in that instance, and I guess my question is, are you doing studies to see what the base nitrates are in the waters? Because it seems to be another source other than agriculture, you've got the oceans being a very significant area.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Messerly, to answer your question is yes, we try to get background information. Again, one of the points I wanted to make with this slide is that typically, what triggers our involvement in starting to monitor for groundwater is somebody else coming to us with an elevated situation. So, unfortunately, a lot of our focus is on problem areas, you know, once they become a problem, versus just trying to get a much better benchmark across the state as a starting point. Similar questions that were asked the other day about our surface water program. But I can talk to the local folks to see what they may have discovered in that area.
Yeah, my memory when I was listening in upstairs, and on the two of us, I wasn't down here, I was listening upstairs, is that there was a leguminous nitrogen fixating water plant that, you know, that we were dealing with. Was that, did I hear that? Was that testimony given last week? Or am I misremembering?
What was that testimony?
I'll let go. I'm not sure.
I'm not aware of that.
All right, I'll take a assessment.
Thank you.
Which that finding was not a water from the lake plant.
No comment from the sheriff. Stress the position of water and scotch. Should we move forward?
Okay.
Ms. Simpson.
Thank you.
Since we've kind of picked apart our local areas here, I wasn't nearly as concerned until we got to your flag, where we have the orange and brown, or orange and black, as the case may be, as how you look at it. But as I look at Umatilla and Morrow County, it would appear that we have probably the highest brown of any of the areas, greatest concentration of this. Would you, and it all seems seemingly congested from about the Hermiston area west to Boardman, if I'm looking at it, the geography correctly there. Can you help me with what's the major problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, actually later in my presentation I'm going to talk specifically about the Umatilla, our groundwater management area, but but I will touch on that.
Thank you.
Sediments, excessive sediment loading is created whenever the land is disturbed and not managed to control sediment input into water. Activities that create sediment, of course, are grading or dredging, grazing, plowing, tree removal, urban construction. But there's just a lot of different types of land disturbance activities that, if not properly managed, can lead to sediment discharge into streams. Sedimentation, as I think most of you are aware of because of some of the issues involved with the Oregon plan, is a concern, obviously, for its impact on spawning areas for fish. But there are other impacts as well. It certainly increases the cost to water purveyors to have to remove sediment before delivery, either for drinking water or industrial use. So sediment is a major issue that we're dealing with in the water quality program.
Question, Mr. Chair. Yes, what's in that for?
I didn't mean to jump in at you.
Okay. The last word this way.
Mr. Chair, I have two different lines of questions. First, I'd like to address when in the permitting process, the Corps of Engineers cannot issue a permit without concurrence of DEQ. And turbidity is a standard that I've had staff people from ODF&W laugh about, saying that, you know, we know that when we're doing our stream surveys and we're walking in the stream, that we are probably in violation of the turbidity rules. And yet it's in, I believe, every permit that it's industrial or agriculture or whatever. And during the interim, I think Mr. Marsh and I had a discussion about this, and I got some information back. The standard came from, as you just stated, the spawning bed, the requirements and the needs of the fisheries for spawning bed. But to apply that standard for all bodies of water doesn't make any sense. Is there any progress in looking at that and changing that standard and making it apply only to where there is gravel spawning beds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nestle, I believe you're referring to the 10% above background turbidity standard.
Yes.
That standard, my understanding of the history of that standard is it's been on the books for many, many years. It was primarily a mechanism to try to quantify somehow that when somebody was going to do an activity, particularly in stream, that we try to limit the amount of sediment that was going to be kicked up and disturbed during that particular action. And that's why in particular it comes up in the Section 401 certification, because as you're aware of, that typically is related to in-stream dredging. Or if you're building bridges or any work in water, it was a value that was identified to try to provide a benchmark for the particular activity to minimize the amount of turbidity. I think that's a little different, though, from a sediment standard that might look at how much sediment in a stream is acceptable in a broad watershed, so it's protective of spawning areas in particular. We have not adopted yet a statewide sediment quantity standard. The only state that I'm aware of that's taken that on has been Idaho, and they've been doing a little rethinking about that because it's just technically difficult. In essence, you're trying to identify what level of sediment can be allowed in a stream that still that might fall into the fish spawning areas but still be protected. We will be taking that on eventually because I think that as it relates certainly to the fish in the Pacific Northwest, it's one of the more important parameters that we have to get at. And I think when we get there and looking at that broader sediment standard would be a very good time to reopen the discussion about where the 10% number came from. But admittedly, Representative Messley, I think the 10% standard was not so much an environmental-based standard in terms of relationship to fish as it was an operational performance standard to try to minimize the disturbance of sediment during in-stream work.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, and I recognize that. I guess my reason for bringing this whole subject up now is we are talking about sediments and we're talking about instances where we're trying to remove the sediments to maintain the health of the streams and the drainage ditches and the bays or the shipping channels, whatever. And this is becoming a huge problem to try to comply with that. By not addressing the standard, I think we're opening the permittee up to third-party lawsuits. And that's problematic, I think, and we should be, as soon as possible, addressing that and try to make something that makes some sense.
Great.
Sir, could I go to another subject, please?
Please.
I'm also concerned about the process, and I want to go back to the incidents we've had in Coos Bay, which ended up applying all up and down the coast and on the Columbia River regarding TBC. And I'm concerned about the process that the department goes through and how you reach putting conditions on permits. And I'm not opposed to looking at conditions and having a thorough review. Kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier. Do you have public hearings and do you go through a process? My experience in dealing with the TBT situation in Coos Bay, which eventually got attention coastwide and eventually got attention even on the Columbia River and the Port of Portland, was that there was tremendous lacking of process of what the concept was developed at the local level. It was not reviewed by levels on up, even to the director's level, of whether this was doable, whether it's feasible, what that means, what the sources are, and all those kind of things. The net result of that is that the port, the industry, in this case Roseburg Forest Products, went through, I believe it was somewhere between 2 and 4 years of hiring consultants, of legal work, of a lot of frustration and a lot of staff time for DEQ, and this is why I want to talk about this now, because as we're reviewing budgets, it seems to me it would be much more efficient to work this through the process and have it reviewed so that we know we're on a good track, a solid track, that we can get some results and it's feasible and it's going to get us to the results we want before we put everybody through all of this very ugly process, quite frankly. And maybe that was an education experience for everyone, but the question is there a process in place now where the department has improved that situation so that in other cases we don't go through that kind of get caught up in the quagmire?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Messler, I think you're correct that there are times where we deal with an issue for the very first time. I think the TBT issue for CEQ was a relatively new one in the 401 certification process. So I would certainly agree with you that it was a learning curve issue. We have tried and will continue to try to make sure that we've got better coordination, particularly in the 401 arena between headquarters and our regional offices. The 401 certifications do have a public comment period. For some reason, unlike many of the wastewater permits that we deal with, we do not get a lot of requests for public comments or public hearings on the 401 certification. I'm not familiar with this particular case in Coos Bay, but it may be why it didn't have as much visibility originally as we would have all liked.
but I agree with your concern that there are times where an issue comes up, there's no precedent for it, as we dealt with 401s or wastewater permits, and we go through a learning curve, and I think that was the case here.
But Mr. Chair, if I could just summarize this, as far as the 401 permit, you know, I know you have a process there, public notification. In this case, it was a new standard. And it looked to me like a process to a review of that standard. And it seemed to me that it would be proper to have public hearings when you are developing a new standard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Messerly, if we get to the point of adopting a sediment quality standard, I've been talking here about sediment quantity, it would be adopted via a rule, which would require public process. And DEQ has a long history of working with technical and policy advisory committees on our water quality standards. That would be a very complex standard, admittedly, but it would go through a full public review.
Mr. Chair, one more. You just raised another
issue. Follow up.
Are you suggesting, and I guess this is what I observed, that you were requiring on a permit a standard that had not been developed through rule yet? And that seems backwards as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Messerly, we have in our water quality standards, as all states do, under the Clean Water Act, what are called narrative criteria, which are, by definition, not a specific number. And those are often used when we're dealing with a pollutant that might be very specific to a state. I think in this case, if I recall, our TBT is related to the shipping building industry, which may not be on a national basis enough for EPA to develop a particular criteria. So TBT wouldn't be the only pollutant where we have an environmental issue in front of us. There's no precedent necessarily at a national basis, but we have to develop the actual criteria on a statewide basis. Eventually, if that is a type of a pollutant that we're going to be using in other parts of the state, we would move it out of the narrative criteria so that it isn't so site-specific and adopt a number that then would be applied to Coos Bay, Portland Harbor, and the main stem of Columbia. But it's not unusual for us to use the narrative criteria if there's no precedent.
Just for the record, my understanding is that TBT not only comes from the shipping industry, but also from residential waste treatment, tile cleaners and tub cleaners and this type of thing. So, and to develop a standard of zero tolerance where you have other sources, again, is problematic. Thank you.
Other questions? I guess the issue for me on sedimentation is the certainty that there's a background of sedimentation in each system at the natural level, that the recruitment of gravel and nutrient and trace elements is as essential to health for salmonids and other aquatic species as clean water, cold water. And I question the idea that you seem to be promoting, which is all sedimentation is bad. We are certainly going to great lengths to eliminate sedimentation as a feature in the natural system. I don't think you can do it. So I guess I'm curious about how we're establishing thresholds and benchmarks and natural background levels of sedimentation.
Mr. Chair, that's a very valid concern. And as I was mentioning, the state of Idaho, at least to my knowledge, is the only state that has attempted at this point to try to adopt a sediment standard. But I'm familiar with one of the issues there is they do try to distinguish the recruitment of sediment and looking at the particular ecoregion of the state as what a natural background, healthy stream would be in terms of sediment from an excessive loading. And clearly that would have to be, when we get into the development of a sediment standard for the state of Oregon, one of the fundamental principles that we'll have to look at in adopting a number or a set of numbers is the difference in these various watersheds and what that sediment load, natural sediment load might be, the size of the sediment that's endemic to that watershed. Toxics is a term that is used to characterize a broad array chemicals that might potentially impact water quality.
Some of the sources of toxics include industrial and municipal discharges that contain industrial, commercial, or household chemicals that pass through the treatment system, because the treatment system wasn't originally designed, perhaps for the particular chemicals that are now showing up. Runoff, obviously, from urban areas, highways, pesticide runoff into streams, both, again, from urban, rural areas, or historical contamination of sediments where perhaps the source has already been eliminated, but the legacy of that contamination still resides. Toxics are a problem, of course, both for human health and for aquatic life. In fact, many toxics tend to bioaccumulate as they are passed along the food chain, from sediment to aquatic insects and to fish, and then ultimately to wildlife as in this picture, or to us people. The impact of toxics can range from just a chronic exposure, which may not be lethal to fish or other aquatic life, but may have impacts to their immune system, reproduction, or other long-term chronic impact. Or they can be, in certain concentrations, obviously lethal, either to fish or the aquatic life and bugs and so forth that live in the stream. Although no water is really advisable to drink directly from a stream due to the existence of bacteria or other microorganisms, excessive loadings of bacteria can come from improperly treated sewage, sewer overflows or bypasses, faulty on-site systems that might be leaking into surface water, poorly managed animal waste. Protection of Oregonians engaged in water contact recreation, such as swimming and fishing, is the main reason for regulating waterborne pathogens. Contact with or ingestion of bacteria can cause skin and respiratory ailments, gastroenteritis, or other illnesses, and may be particularly harmful to children given that their lower immune system. Sure.
Question?
Go back up to the top sheet. You don't need to go back into the small edition of the subject. In the Portland Airport, I'm troubled by how severe that problem is with the de-icing.
I understand we're in Denver, or some of the eastern states where they deal with snow and ice on a regular basis, at least during the wintertime, how there's a tremendous amount of material. In my conversations with some of the port people, normally it's 1 to 3 events a year, and those events can last from 1 to 3 days. This year, they've had only one event, and I think it only lasted for 1 or maybe 2 days. It gets to the point of ridiculous. And so we're doing the moving towards requiring any agency or any individual to spend millions of dollars to try to correct where you have that low of an incidence. Are we working, or are there other avenues that we can go to such as holding ponds to let it dissipate over the other 364 days of the year or whatever? Or it seems to me that from the conversations we've had on this and other committees this year, that there's quite a push to require them to put in a treatment facility or to hook up to the city treatment facility, and tremendous expense if we're talking about 1 or 2 events a year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, the problem with the glycol that they use is, I believe, not that it's directly toxic to fish, but that it consumes the oxygen in the flue and causes the problem for them, their survival. The permit that this DEQ has issued to the port does require them to fix the problem, but doesn't tell them exactly how. And the port has been studying various alternatives, including discharge to the river, the Columbia River, the wastewater treatment plant, the city of Portland, and what you were referring to, a series of holding tanks, treatment systems, and so forth that they would pursue on site. And it appears as though they have now chosen to go in the direction of a combination of some discharge to the Columbia Wastewater Treatment Facility in the city of Portland and a series of lagoon and preliminary pre-treatment that would allow them to meter the discharge out to the slough in a way that wouldn't cause a problem with the fish. So we have not yet evaluated those systems that they're proposing, but they do have some options. And obviously, our joint interest is in trying to find the most cost-effective solution to that problem.
Okay, I have one more question. We've had discussions about the combined sewer systems in the state, and I believe you were going to get back to us with the updated information on that. Have we received that, and was I just absent when it came in, or are you still working on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, I can give, we are providing a very detailed summary of the CSO history for you. We'll provide to the full committee for Astoria, Portland, and Corvallis. But essentially, as I think you may know, that the city of Portland in particular is under an order to go from a situation where they have roughly, in an average year, about 50 events, down to a design where in the winter there would be one event statistically every 5 years, and in the summer one event statistically every 10 years. So orders of magnitude from the current, I think, about 6 billion gallons per year of CSO, combined sewer overflows, to about 300 million gallons per year, which about 80% of that is actually stormwater rather than just in the raw sewage. So it's a massive undertaking. But we will provide you in our written summary the history of what we know about just the progress of where Portland started and where they will end up under the order by the year, I believe it's 2011. The same for Astoria and Corvallis.
Chair, for that follow-up. I believe last session, Mr. Marks, you gave us information as to how many days per year that those events happened, how much rainfall it took to make that event happen, and how many, I believe it was 6.2 billion gallons, we were told last year. I'm interested in an update to know how much we've improved, how far along we are, and how we compare with 2 years ago.
Mr. Chair, we'll include that information in the report. We have been receiving updated information from the City of Portland that indicates that some of their interim projects that they have been doing, things like for some of the connection of roof drains and that sort of thing, has actually resulted in a significant reduction and the amount of CSOs that have occurred over the last few years. So there should be we have been seeing, and I think we should see a positive trend in reduction of those amounts.
Chair, one more brief one. You mentioned that the goal is to have one in 10-year event in the summer during the recreation season. I'm having trouble understanding that. I understand that you can't build a system to take 100% of all events in the wintertime. But the summer flows, I can't imagine where you'd have that big of an event during the recreation season to where you would have overflows. And I think, for me, that's the biggest problem, the contamination of the river. And in most cases, are you going to notify people who would normally be swimming, skiing, and those kind of things in the river, or even fishing? Could you explain how that could be an event in that season?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Messerly, I think you're correct that what we're talking about is a statistical evaluation that once every 10 years Portland gets a big rain event or a series of days in which just the total volume of water, even with all the corrections that they're making, still would result in a combined sewer overflow. As a matter of fact, most sewer systems, even those that aren't some of these older systems that have combined sewers as a part of the infrastructure, from an engineering standpoint, at some point are designed or maybe under-designed for a relatively abnormal storm event. In other non-CSO communities, basically you get raw bypassing that goes right around the sewage treatment plant, or in worst case, you know, popping of manholes to back up into people's basements, which obviously we don't want to have happen. But I think the real issue is at some point you just run into sort of the marginal cost of getting that final 100% done. The engineering feasibility, and that's what we're dealing with here with Portland. And it's really the same way across the country with these larger urban areas that were built originally with combined sewers, Boston, New York, LA, Seattle. They're all dealing with the same massive problem of trying to eliminate these sewer systems that were built 100 years ago.
Any further clarification?
Further clarification?
Again, I understand in the middle of winter when you have a major storm come through that you need to have some capacity for an overflow.
Comparing that to what might happen in the summer season, even if you had a week of showers, I don't see the correlation where you could reach that level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messler, perhaps what we can do is provide you a very specific example where the volume of water in a particular summer event was equal to the volume of water that might have triggered a winter storm. It's just the same amount of water. But I think you're correct that in the summer it's much less likely. That's why it's the 1 in 10 year versus 1 in 5 year. It's just a volume of water issue.
Thank you. Question, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow a little bit with where Representative Messler has started, and I'm not really sure that I understood, Mr. Mark, that you answered his basic question. And I think that, to me, the basic question having to do with Portland Airport and de-icing was whether or not we're looking at spending millions and millions of dollars to deal with problems, if we put it in perspective with where other international airports of comparable size in the United States, but who have substantially and significantly greater de-icing problems, don't seem to have the same issue. I've asked once before the question in relationship to the Minneapolis-St. Paul, and I got a kind of an answer there that they didn't have a river. Well, I've made a number of approaches personally in aircraft in and out of that airport, and I fly right over the Mississippi River in doing it. So that, and I know that they have a lot more de-icing problems than we have at Portland, and so I'm curious of how these people handle it as contrasted to how we're handling it, where we have only a few events in the course of the year, and they have daily events throughout the entire winter season.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I think your problem faced by the Port of Portland and the Portland International Airport is that they have to make an investment, a significant investment, for relatively few events, whereas these other airports have made substantial investments, many of them, but they're more able to spread the cost of those investments over more events during the course. So they're operating these systems on a more constant basis than is the case here. So I think, as I understood Representative Messler's question, it was that to get the level of protection we're asking for the Columbia flu, we're demanding of the Port of Portland a fairly significant investment for a very a relatively infrequent event. And I guess the only answer I could give is that in doing the TMDL for the Columbia flu, that the introduction of even those relatively infrequent slugs of de-icing agents did cause significant problems that required correction. And that I think the best answer that I can give is that we need to keep working with the port to reach the fix, whether it's one event or five or more events that they may that may occur during the course of the winter to make that investment as cost-effective as you can so that they don't over-invest relative to the size of the problem that they've got to deal with.
When we had our hearing in Portland, Excellent Jensen, the issue, as you know, was the relative infrequency, the concentration in the Columbia River through the lack of dilution, which is the primary issue, not the toxicity of the agents or the carrier. But I think the Port District is responding by putting forward a management plan to deal with all those issues. I think we've seen some rather significant, very recent changes in at least proposed directions for the port. Sort of a watch this space situation. Colleagues, we have a closed session at 10 this morning. So the I'll ask the panel to conclude its deliberations and considerations for the committee so that the Senate can convene at the end of the meeting at 10:30. And we find a convenient place for anyone.
Yes. Just, Mr. Chair, I have maybe three more slides that would get us to a natural stopping point.
Oh, and the other thing is I guess it would only take one outbreak of cholera to be a statistically significant event. Well, even though the relative release of these bacteria are rare, fairly infrequent, it would be a pretty serious issue, a public health issue, if we had an epidemic caused by an overflow.
I've been focusing a lot on the in-stream issues associated with concerns about water quality, and I know several of you have been very involved in the salmon issues and have been involved in a lot of discussions about physical changes to stream systems, particularly riparian areas. If the stream channel is straightened and vegetation removed from the banks, woody debris removed, etc., the effect can increase temperature in the stream, sediment, as we talked about, being excessive, which impacts fish spawning areas. So this physical aspect is not necessarily pollution within the stream, but how the health of the watershed impacts water quality is obviously an issue that we're very involved in, particularly in the TMDL arena, and I'll be talking more about TMDL when I get into the Oregon plan. So as you can see, we talked, or I talked a lot about the chemical or chemistry of stream systems as being very important, obviously, for water quality, physical impacts to the stream, which also have their effect, and the biological health of the stream is also important. So all three of these issues, the biology, the chemistry, and the physical aspects of the watershed ultimately impact whether or not our streams here in Oregon are healthy. The final slide, then, that I'll leave with you is, how do we get our hands around these various potential threats? The mechanism that is used clearly under the Federal Clean Water Act is to establish water quality standards. These standards describe the necessary attributes to define water quality and are identified through a promulgation of a water quality standard in rule. If the standards impact surface waters, they must be submitted to the Environmental Protection Agency for approval. And a recent phenomenon here in the Pacific Northwest, because of the Endangered Species Act, is that those standards also go through a consultation with the National Marine Fisheries Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. DEQ is responsible for establishing water quality standards, which become then the benchmark that identify the desired quality of water to protect both public health and aquatic life. Water quality standards then become the basis for various management decisions ranging from our permit issuance to non-point source activities that the Department of Forestry or the Department of Agriculture have primacy in terms of dealing with. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just stop because we'll get next into the various tools that DEQ has for water quality.
Okay, any final questions for the committee? Seeing none, we are in adjournment until tomorrow, where we will continue with the presentation of House Bill 5019 and the discussion of the Department of Environmental Quality budget.